What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbis Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor Sharon Megdal, Director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Center and one of the world's experts on dry lands water usage, discussing water issues and cooperation in the Middle East, including Israel, Jordan, and the Palestinian Authority. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The Jewish holiday of Shavuot is coming up this week. Shavuot is the Feast of Weeks, celebrating receiving the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. It concludes the process of counting the Omer that enumerated the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuos, the 50 days from the Holiday of Freedom to the Festival of Covenant. Shavuot is also called Chag HaBikurim, Festival of First Fruits, falling as it does in late spring when the earliest crops of summer begin to ripen in hot climates like Israel, or I suppose Arizona. It's unfortunate that my people will theoretically be celebrating a major festival this week that oddly most Jews don't even remember exists. If you were to ask a Jewish friend or neighbor to name the most important Jewish holidays, you would very likely get a list that goes something like this. Shabbat, the weekly Sabbath, of course. Passover, Hanukkah, the High Holy Days in the fall, you know, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur. And then Sukkot, perhaps? You know, that holiday in autumn with booths. And maybe, if they have young kids, they might say Purim. If they're high on Israel, Yom HaAtzmaut, Israeli Independence Day. Perhaps even Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, would get a mention. But Shavuot? Which one is that again? Something about cheesecake? That omission is really a shame, because in truth, Shavuot, which begins Thursday night, continuing Friday and Saturday, is an important holiday indeed. It was on Shavuot that, according to Jewish tradition, the greatest human interaction with God in all of history took place. At this time of year, over 3,200 years ago, we received the Ten Commandments from God in a most dramatic fashion. According to the book of Exodus, the giving of the commandments was preceded by lightning and thunder, smoke, fire, an earthquake, and the blast of the shofar ringing in the clear desert air. Suddenly, out of all that tumult, God's voice called out the greatest message of ethics of all, one that still forms the basis for Western religious morality today. Without the holiday of Shavuot, we don't have the Torah, and without the Torah, we don't have Judaism. And of course, if we don't have Judaism, we would never have had Christianity or Islam or Western civilization, for that matter. So Shavuot, or as some Jews call it, Shavuos, matters very much. When celebrating a holiday with this much importance, especially a profoundly underappreciated festival like Shavuot, it's important to talk about what we really believe happened at Mount Sinai. Since this is a Jewish question, of course, there are multiple answers. If you're Orthodox, you theoretically believe that not only the Ten Commandments were given aloud to the entire nation of Israelites, but the whole Torah, all five books, was also given at the same time. And, by the way, so was the rest of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, including events still far off in the future. If you are not Orthodox, if you are progressive or reform or conservative, reconstructionist or renewal, you probably don't believe God gave us all that text at Mount Sinai, but you may very well believe something extraordinary took place on that mountain in that wilderness on that long ago day, and that it made a huge impression on the people assembled, and all of us who have inherited that collective memory ever since. Can you name the Ten Commandments by heart? I mean, of course, I can. I'm a rabbi. In my Exodus Project class at Congregation Beit Simcha, we've been going through the Ten Commandments in great depth for the past few weeks, and I have to say, they still work amazingly well as a basis for personal morality. Don't murder, don't steal, don't lie, don't pervert justice. These form a darn good place to start if you wish to live a morally good and valuable life. And we commemorate that great beginning this coming Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday on Shavuot. So let's have a little play-in on the subject of Mount Sinai from the Boston Camerata, a little song to Moses, composed in the Middle Ages by a convert to Judaism named Ovadia. Mi al Har Chorev, literally, who on Mount Sinai spoke to God face to face. Mi al Har Chorev for the holiday of Shavuot, Shavuos, this coming Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday. Don't miss it. It was also Yom Yerushalayim last week, the day when Israel celebrated the reunification of Jerusalem during the Six-Day War back in 1967, the moment when we were again able to reach the Kotel, the Western Wall, to pray after being blocked from the holiest site in the world for Jews. Play us in this morning. Also, here's a classic song about Jerusalem, written just before the Six-Day War broke out, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. The original verses are filled with longing for the eternal capital of the Jewish people. Jews were prevented any access to that holiest place by the guns of the Jordanian army for a long time. But a fourth, additional verse, added by composer Naomi Shemer just after the war, was filled with hope after the liberation of the old city allowed us to come again to Jerusalem of gold. As sung by its original singer, Shuli Natan, whom I had the privilege of hosting in my home here in Tucson just a few years ago.
Katonti mi tzeir banayich u me'achron בשפתיים, כי נשיקת שעריו, אם אשכחך ירושלים, אשר כולה זהב. ירושלים של זהב, ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא לכל שירייך אני כינור. ירושלים של זהב, ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא לכל שירייך אני כינור. חזרנו אל בורות המים, לשוק ולכיכר, שופר קורא בהר הבית, מהיר העתיקה. ובמערות אשר בסלע, אלפי שמשות זורחות, נשוב נרד אל ים המלח, בדרך יריחו. ירושלים של זהב, ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא לכל שירייך אני כינור. ירושלים של זהב, ושל נחושת ושל אור, הלא לכל שירייך אני
That was Shuli Natan singing the classic song Yerushalayim Shel Zahav for Jerusalem Day last week. We'll return in a moment here on Two Jewish. Professor Sharon Megdal will tell us just how important water is in the Middle East and how much Israel and the Arabs cooperate about it. Find out when we return in a moment here on Two Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring and summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson of the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the Tucson metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and, of course, festivals, celebrations. Beit Simcha is located at 2270 West Ina Road, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone in normal times. In these days of coronavirus tsoras, join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. on Facebook Live. Saturday morning, Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beit Simcha Tucson, and we'll hold services with full music by virtual experience until we're allowed to come back in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are on Zoom. You can access them by emailing me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org. Our synagogue's at 2270 West Ina Road, west of La Cholla, on the north side of Ina, at the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building, not inside the mall. We are a fully functioning virtual congregation on Zoom and Facebook. Email me at rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information or go to our website, beitsimchatucson.org. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, sign up for our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of adult education academy courses and conversion classes, all taught right now on Zoom. And, of course, all of our services on Facebook. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the fastest-growing Jewish synagogue in southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our friend, Professor Sharon Megdahl. She's the director of the Water Resources Center at the University of Arizona and one of the world's experts on, I don't know, dry land, irrigation, water issues. What's the best way to describe your expertise?
Water management in water-scarce regions, I would say.
Well, one of those regions, of course, is Arizona, but another is Israel and really the whole Middle East. And you have done a great deal of work in Israel and in comparing and in sort of analyzing the water issues and the ways that water is managed and shared. And, you know, cooperation in the Middle East is always a difficult thing to achieve. This might be one of the success stories.
Well, there are a lot of success stories, even where there remain challenges. And the technology that Israel has developed and implemented in terms of desalination of seawater and also agricultural irrigation are technologies used around the world as well as regionally there. And so we have some excellent success stories. But we also have challenges because these issues of water scarcity in an era of climate change and growing populations they're challenging issues, and they require a lot of attention and a lot of cooperation among many different parties.
So that's always true. It's true in Arizona where, you know, people squabble about water usage, but in an area in which, say, the Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, and Syria are the other major players with Israel, I guess Lebanon to a degree, that has to be infinitely more complicated, doesn't it?
It is complicated. And in a way, a lot of my work really has been built upon the similarities of our region where we live in Tucson, Arizona, in the Colorado River Basin, and that region. And if you take a look at the Jordan River, you do have five different geopolitical entities utilizing that river water. And the Bible speaks about the mighty Jordan River, yet it's a trickle in not very good shape quality-wise that feeds to the Dead Sea. So when you think about iconic river bodies, whether it's the lower Jordan River, the Dead Sea, they're very much impacted by the water use of multiple entities, and they're affected by natural conditions of drought and climate change. Human-caused conditions like disposal of, let's say, inadequately treated wastewater, all these things figure in and affect the water supplies that people rely on for multiple purposes and nature relies on.
You know, I remember that song we used to sing in choir, the Jordan River is deep and wide. It is neither. We'll talk some more about the Jordan, the Dead Sea, water usage, desalination, all of that with Professor Sharon Megdahl. We come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com, TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So you noted, when we were talking off mic, a really interesting phenomenon among the countries that have been most effective at dealing with coronavirus, COVID-19, which is that their prime ministers or presidents or leaders are women.
Right. there are countries which otherwise don't have a lot in common. But if you look at New Zealand, Germany, Iceland, Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all the countries that have appeared to do the best job of not only flattening the curve, but in the case of New Zealand, actually eliminating the virus from the country. Now, you can say that some of these countries have some natural advantages, like New Zealand, it's two islands.
Yeah. And a long way from anywhere else.
Right. And Iceland is an island where they already have genetic info for everybody in the country.
Right.
And
right.
they've tested, you know, something approaching 100% of their population. Now, all this could change, of course, in the coming weeks, and maybe these women won't look so terrific a month from now. But right now, it is, I think, more than coincidence that countries run by women are just generally doing a lot better than countries run by men. There are some exceptions in each direction, but so the question becomes why? Why would that be the case? And I think that part of the reason is that citizens pay more attention to and have more confidence in leaders who express empathy with their situations, and not merely sympathy, like, oh, it's too bad, but really show that they get where people are at. And generally, statistically speaking, women are a lot better at that. They have a lot more empathy. They have a lot more compassion. You know, men want to send soldiers off to fight, and women want to keep the peace at all costs and save their children and grandchildren. So, you know, there are obvious exceptions to this, but if we look at the history of modern Israel, I mean, I think a strong argument can be made that Golda Meir was the best prime minister Israel ever had.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking about the famous quote from Golda Meir, which is, we don't blame the Arabs. I'm going to mess this up a little. We don't blame the Arabs for killing our children. We blame the Arabs for making our children kill their children.
Right.
You know, that's approximately right. And it was that sense of empathy that there's something really tragic going on here. We have to understand that we're doing this, but we hate the fact that we're doing this. We'd love to stop doing this. Like, that just became... It was such an Israeli thing, and but not something I think any male prime minister of Israel has ever said or come close to saying.
Right. And it's also something that over the years since Golda, under a series of male prime ministers, I think Israel's moved further and further away from that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. Maybe they need another female prime minister. There's not one on the docket, as far as I can tell. The closest
right.
we came was somebody who couldn't form a government. But, of course, that's not a unique experience lately in Israel, now that they
right.
do have a government. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sharon meets her friend Miriam, who has just gone through her third divorce. "You poor girl," says Sharon. "You must be absolutely shattered. I feel so sorry for you." "Please don't worry about me," says Miriam. "I might not be a perfect wife, but I'm a very positive person, and I still take great pride in all the things I know how to do well." "Like what?" asks Sharon. "Well, for example," replies Miriam, "I know I'm a good housekeeper, and I'm very proud to say it." "Don't take offense, Miriam," says Sharon, "but that doesn't sound all that important to me." "Well, to me it's very important," says Miriam, "because whenever I leave a man, I always keep his house." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, we will see the Jewish world diverge on Torah portions. The festival of Shavuot begins Thursday night, and conservative and Orthodox Jews outside of Israel observe 2 days of this festival. That means that the second day of Shavuot falls on Saturday, and the weekly Torah portion that would otherwise be chanted that day is deferred to the following week. On the other hand, Reform Jews and Jews in Israel celebrate Shavuos for just one day, and we'll read the Torah portion of Naso from the book of Bamidbar, Numbers, this coming Saturday. which makes things a little confusing. And the two cycles, Israel and the non-Reform diaspora, won't link up again for like 5 weeks until the 4th of July, when we'll double up two Torah portions to get things back on track. So what cycle are we going to follow here on Too Jewish? What will we do? Well, frankly, it's not that hard of a decision. Since Shavuot falls this weekend and lots more American Jews go to synagogue on Shabbat morning when it's a festival than go when it's on a weekday, even when it's a festival, even when it's Friday, we're going to cover the Shavuot readings this week on Too Jewish and work our way through the rest of the Torah readings and numbers as they come up, syncing with the American Orthodox and conservative congregations rather than with Israel or the Reform congregations. It's idiosyncratic, eclectic, even eccentric. But after all, it is my show, and that's what my own congregation, Beit Simcha, is doing, so here goes. As befits a holiday dedicated to Torah, we have two portions on Shavuot. The second, which we'll read Saturday, focuses on the rituals of the festivals, including Shavuot itself. The first portion, chanted on Friday morning traditionally, is rather better known. For the first day of Shavuot, we will chant the Ten Commandments, the most famous statements on morality found in world or at least Western religion. According to tradition, they were given to God by the hand of Moses on Mount Sinai. The Hebrew name for the Ten Commandments is Aseret HaDibrot, almost generically titling them the Ten Statements, as though they were like all other divine sayings. The distinction we make is interesting. Mitzvot, commandments, are direct orders with specific implications. Dibrot, divine statements, are both broader categories of instruction and sometimes more enlightening. There are also arguably far more than Ten Commandments in these statements, and it's also true that some of them are not commandments at all. The Ten begin with, "I am the Lord your God," which is a powerful statement of God's existence, but not a specific command to believe. There are both a few positive, honor your father and mother, honor the Sabbath day and keep it holy, that is, observe the Shabbat, and a longer series of negative commandments. Don't have other gods. Don't take God's name in vain. Don't murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. Don't bear false witness. Don't covet what isn't yours. It's a powerful series of statements about what it takes to live an ethical life. But it's also understood in Judaism to be far from complete. For we have not 10 commandments in Judaism, but 613. Mitzvot, ethical commands, form the structure of a life of goodness. Recounting the centrality of these 10 statements is a reminder that there is much more to being a moral person and a good Jew than even these great sentences can convey. May we each be inspired to seek the influence of commandments of meaning and purpose in our own lives, on this Shavuot, and always. The second Torah reading, which we typically would chant on the second day of Shavuot, is from the book of Deuteronomy. It spells out the observances for all the holidays and the elaborate ritual cycle. In Judaism, living a good life must include the regular reminders that ritual observances provide. You can't just be good alone. You must be part of a community that celebrates God together, even if it's done on the internet. A personal invitation, please join us for Shavuot services and study, which you can do, well, from anywhere. We'll hold our Tikkun Leil Shavuot this coming Thursday at 8 p.m., studying on Zoom about important moments in Jewish belief. And Friday night and Saturday morning, our Facebook Live services will include the Shavuot Festival celebrations, including on Saturday, Yisker Memorial Prayers. Join us and have a wonderful Shavuos. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Professor Sharon Megdahl, will explain just what is happening now with the water situation in Israel, including the status of the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Our brothers, our sons of Israel.
As Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu moved towards annexing parts or perhaps all of the West Bank with the blessing of the Trump administration, last week Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas declared an end to all agreements with Israel, including security cooperation, effectively turning over to Israel's government the running of the entire West Bank. The Palestine Liberation Organization, the State of Palestine, are absolved as of today of all the agreements and understandings with the American and Israeli governments and of all the commitments based on these understandings and agreements, including the security ones, Abbas said in a speech of Ramallah, which functions as the capital of the Palestinian Authority. The Israeli Occupation Authority, as of today, has to shoulder all responsibilities and obligations in front of the international community as an occupying power over the territory of the occupied state of Palestine, with all its consequences and repercussions, Mahmoud Abbas said. It's not clear what steps Abbas will take next. In the past, he has threatened to end agreements that he claims Israel has already abrogated before retreating from those threats. The finality of this statement, however, seems to herald the collapse of the Palestinian Authority, last vestige of the Oslo peace talks, as well as the dismantling of security cooperation with Israel, which Israeli security chiefs have long said is critical to keeping the West Bank relatively quiet. Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's plan to annex parts of the West Bank left him no choice. He blamed the Trump administration's peace vision unveiled in January for empowering Netanyahu. That plan allows Israel to annex some territory, but in coordination, at least in theory, with the Palestinians. Abbas said the PLO remained committed to the two-state outcome, adding he planned to seek recognition of statehood in a number of international forums. The Trump administration and Israel have cautioned the Palestinians against seeking statehood recognition. They describe it as a unilateral act, the same term Palestinians use to describe Netanyahu's annexation plans. The U.S. does not have much leverage to use against Abbas. The Trump administration has already cut almost all assistance to the Palestinians, except money for security cooperation, which is now apparently officially ending. A growing number of Ramah summer camps have canceled their sessions for the summer, the latest in a lengthening list of Jewish camps that will not run this year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Conservative movement camps join reform movement camps, which have already canceled all summer sessions. Six of the Ramah camps that have canceled are sleepaway camps. One is a day camp. The canceled summer camps affiliated with conservative Judaism are Ramah Berkshires, Ramah in the Rockies, Ramah in Canada, Ramah New England, Ramah in the Poconos, Ramah Sports Academy in Connecticut, Ramah Nyack, and finally Ramah Wisconsin, which serves the Midwest and is the longest-running Ramah camp. These sad decisions mean that all of Ramah's 10 overnight camps will almost certainly be closed this summer. Ramah Northern California and Ramah Darom in Georgia have already canceled. Ramah in California, located in Ojai in the southern part of the state, one of my alma maters, has said it will likely cancel too. Collectively, these camps serve thousands of campers. They join dozens of other Jewish camps that have canceled summers due to the pandemic. In some cases, government regulations prohibit the camps from opening. Some other camps have decided opening would pose an unreasonable health risk. Only a few Jewish camps have announced that they actually intend to open. And most Israelis who had the COVID-19 virus were infected with a strain that originated in the U.S., a study found. About 70% of the infected patients were infected by Americans visiting Israel or Israelis who brought the virus back from the U.S. That's according to research from Tel Aviv University. Most of the other 30% who got the virus in Israel were infected with a strain that came from Europe. No cases in Israel, none, originated directly from China or other Asian countries. The study also found a small number of super spreaders were responsible for most of the infections. No one told you life was gonna be this way. Your job's a joke, you broke, your love life's the old way. It's like you're always stuck in second gear. And finally, a British teen got more than he bargained for when his virtual Friends theme bar mitzvah video visit 2 months later from one of the hit sitcom's stars. Naftali Arden invited dozens of family and friends from England, Israel, and the U.S. to attend his virtual bar mitzvah in March, but some 4,000 fans of the show Friends also logged on. The bar mitzvah is believed to be the first virtual celebration to come out of the United Kingdom. That response landed Naftali an appearance via a video chat on The Late Late Show with James Corden, a fellow Friends fanatic last week. Naftali says he's seen the whole series 7 times. After Corden recapped the bar mitzvah, he invited a second guest on the video chat, saying, "A friend of mine was also impressed by your whole bar mitzvah, wanted to pop in and say hi too." Courtney Cox, who played Monica Geller in the popular show, she was Jewish on the show, although not in real life, then appeared on a split screen. "Oh my gosh, hello," Naftali said. A new friend, if you will. Plans for his bar mitzvah called for tables named after each of the 6 main characters in the series would have included a foosball table like the one in Joey and Chandler's apartment. Courtney Cox announced she would send Naftali a foosball table as her bar mitzvah gift. That sitcom ended in May 2004, 2 years before the bar mitzvah boy was born. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Professor Sharon Magdal, is a good friend. We just said earlier, I definitely didn't want to call her an old friend. It makes me sound old. It makes you sound old. Definitely not doing that. She is one of the world's experts on dry lands water usage. She's director of the Water Resources Center at the University of Arizona. We started speaking about Israel, of course, many similarities in dry lands water usage anywhere in the world. We started talking about the Jordan River. The Jordan River is, although when you raft on it and there isn't enough water to float a raft a lot of times, it makes you wonder, how could that possibly be a major source of water for the region? And yet it is. Can you explore some of the challenges there?
Well, yes, you do have entities, countries, relying on the upper Jordan, which feeds into the Sea of Galilee, the Kinneret. That's the largest lake in that part of the world, and that the inflows into the Sea of Galilee have diminished over time as the Upper Jordan River, riparian countries, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan also uses it, Israel, and then you have in the lower Jordan River area, the Palestinians utilizing that water. The supplies have been diminished over time due to climate change and the areas experiencing increasing temperatures, sometimes changing and diminished precipitation patterns. So you've got the Sea of Galilee that's experienced some of the lowest inflow in the last 100 years, just in the last few years. That water is then used by both Israel and supplied to Jordan through the peace treaty, and then what isn't used flows down into the lower Jordan, and then that's used yet again, and then that is what flows into the Dead Sea, and you've got growing areas. One of the things I think about every time I'm in the region is just look at the number of people there, and they're all relying on pretty much the same natural sources of water that were there, and so more being taken out, and that's why you've got the whole effort to increase the utilization of recycled water, particularly by agriculture, and then manufactured water, if that's what you'd like to call desalinated seawater. You've got more people, more activity, more demand, and diminished supply, so that brings about stresses on the natural water system.
The Jordan, is still under great strain. There were some interesting stories about the fact that Kinneret, the Sea of Galilee, seems to be returning to a better base level. For a while, it just was sort of disappearing. Can you address that a little bit?
Well, there's been a focus on the need for water for nature. In fact, over a decade ago, the Israeli Knesset and the law was changed to recognize that nature needs water and that all water should not be just used for human needs. At the same time, there was a concerted effort to increase the level of treatment of waste flows so that the water flowing into the Jordan River would be a better quality. So between the improvements of the inflows and the water quality, at the same time, there's been an effort to increase the flow into the Jordan River. I would say that some of the environmental community would say nowhere near enough, but getting more is better. And so there has been an improvement in the water quality. And I can't speak so much to the flows of the Lower Jordan because I haven't looked at the actual flows over time. But when I visited it, you know, it's not a mighty river, but it's there still, and it is supporting some of the nature along the way.
Many of us have gone to Israel, floated in the Dead Sea, and have seen the Dead Sea shrink and shrink and shrink. There have been a variety of plans floated and even some maybe pipelines started. Tell us what the status of the Dead Sea is right now in terms of water usage or in terms of restoring it, perhaps.
The Dead Sea is an interesting body of water, and when I give lectures about the region, I sometimes show a graphic that shows how it has shrunk. And it used to be basically one body of water that extended fairly far to the south where the water is used for potash processing. And over time, it's shrunk so much that there are two water bodies now. One is the what I call the real Dead Sea, the part to the north, and then the part to the south where there's water is really water that's taken from the real Dead Sea, the northern part, conveyed south, and then used for evaporation for potash processing. And so we have industrial demands on the Dead Sea that are actually taking water from that shrunken Dead Sea and transporting it down. At the same time, the sea is shrinking because of less inflow and the like. Now, one of the proposed solutions or partial solutions, this is an example of a wicked water problem where you can't just say here is the solution to the problem and go implement it. But something that was examined by the World Bank several years ago was some large-scale desalination of water from the Red Sea with the brine, the byproduct water that can't be used, being pumped into the Dead Sea to increase the quantity of water in the Dead Sea. And in fact, there is a pilot effort that's been underway for some time. I think it's gotten to the point of accepting some bids for construction to build a desalination plant in the Aqaba region, the Jordan side of the Dead Sea, and produce some water that can be used in the south of Jordan, sold to Israel for the south of Israel and the Arava and Eilat region. And then there would be a pump water into the Dead Sea. At the same time, Israel would provide more water from the north to Amman and the northern part of Jordan. So that's an example of where Jordan and Israel and also the Palestinian territories came together, I believe, in 2013 to enter into an agreement for this Red Sea, Dead Sea project. But it also has faced some challenge due to geopolitical issues and delays, and will likely be built, but exactly how the water will be allocated, I think, is still subject to determination. I would add that I think now that Israel has a government in place after a period of time without it, maybe some budget decisions will be made that could help that project move forward. I heard that it was stalled because of inability to get some budgetary decisions made by Israel.
It would be great to see the Dead Sea kind of beginning to move back the other direction. You know, it's always so strange to go there and see these hotels which are built on the shore that are now, you know, 300 feet or hundreds of yards away from the water itself.
Right, and that water by those hotels that you're referring to on the Israel side is actually kind of that water used for processing the potash. Some of those beaches up on the northern part where there weren't the hotels, at least I think Mineral Beach has been closed, one that I visited I think in 2012 because of problems of sinkholes and just it being unsafe.
Right. In providing water, one of the, I mean, it's obviously challenging dealing with people who don't believe you have a right to exist, or they dealing with people that you feel are colonizing you. And yet there has been a fair amount of water cooperation in the region. Where does the water, say, for people living in Gaza come from now?
Well, the Gaza situation is really a challenging one because they're relying on very limited groundwater. There are issues of saline intrusion, and there's simply inadequate water supply in the area. And so there has been discussion of future desalination plant and that being an important source of water going forward. But the Gaza is very water stressed right now. It's different from the situation where you have more, let's say, connected infrastructure and potential for connected infrastructure, such as in the West Bank. But there, too, the geopolitical issues loom large, not only in terms of the potable water delivery, but also treatment of wastewater. The East Jerusalem wastewater treatment situation has been pending for some time, and there are issues of, you know, who controls the water, who controls the wastewater and its use. And these are tied up into geopolitical issues. On the technical side, they're immensely resolvable through treatment technologies and collection systems for wastewater. But often it's these other issues that affect the ability to work towards solutions, let's say on a time frame that we would all like to see.
We talk often, people in the water field talk about the efficiency of the use of water. America is not exactly legendary in this area. What is the efficiency like in terms of the use of water and recycling water and so on in Israel right now?
The efficiency there is very high. The reuse of treated wastewater from the Tel Aviv region, Israel's renowned for the high level of utilization for agriculture in the northern Negev, and other more decentralized wastewater treatment plants, not the big one in the Shafdan in Tel Aviv, are supplying water for agriculture. The agricultural water use is very efficient through drip, pressurized spray, not the kind of flood irrigation that we still see utilized a lot here in the United States, although some of that is more efficient than people think it is, but that's not what we're talking about this morning. So the agricultural water efficiency is well known and respected worldwide. We also have to look at the residential side, and the delivery system for water in Israel has a very low leakage rate. So you don't have water leaked like you might have in some of the older systems right here in the United States. I do have to say here in Tucson, we have a very good system for capturing losses and measuring losses. But you look at older places like Philadelphia, for example, they've historically had large loss rates where water isn't even getting to the homes because it's lost between the treatment plant and the properties. In Israel, you have a very efficient municipal system for delivery, and you also have a very, very high level of just water consciousness and conservation ethic of consumers where water's just not wasted. And fortunately, we have that here in Tucson most of the time, but I still shudder sometimes when I see water being wasted, you know, as I'm driving around town and so forth. But the conservation ethic, the efficiency of water use are both very, very high in Israel.
desalination, I just want to talk about it briefly because it's become a big part of Israel's mix of water supplies. Are there problems with that desalination? Is it, generally speaking, a really positive thing? Can you address a little bit?
The assessment of desalination to meet drinking water needs, or let's just say good quality water provision, is accepted in many areas. There are two major things that come up whenever you talk about desalination. One is the energy carbon footprint associated with it, because a lot of energy is needed to push the water through the membranes. And then the disposal of the brine, the byproduct. So, for example, in an ocean water desalination plant, typically for a quantity of water you push through the membranes, about half of it comes out as good water, and then the other half has to be disposed, and it's highly concentrated saline water. And so there are always questions about what are the implications of that brine disposal. Experts believe that the dissolution, the dissipation of it when it goes back out to the sea, pushed out a ways, is the solution is that dissolving or dissolution of the water. That's not the same situation when you talk about inland desalination of what's considered brackish salty water. Sometimes that's done through evaporation ponds. The great advantage that Israel does have is it's got the Mediterranean Sea. And because of that, it has a ready source of water for desalination. It's built 5 large-scale desalinations and is working on the 6th, and I think the plan showed the 7th. And so the numbers say that in not that long a period of time, about 85% of potable drinking water needs will come from desalinated seawater. The two issues of the carbon footprint can sometimes be dealt with through using different sources of energy and offset and the like. And the brine disposal thus far, people are seeing as okay when you're discharging it to the ocean. But these are things that are studied and watched, and fortunately they've got an ocean or sea there. We in our region do not, and so we look here in our region to possible partnerships with Mexico or this brackish water desalination to make use of the desalination technology to help our water situation here. But it is a very important part of the water solution set, although not everybody is a big fan.
I want to thank Professor Sharon Migdal for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about your work and Drylands Water?
I'd suggest they start by going to the Water Resources Research Center's website, which is wrrc.arizona.edu. And I'm always glad to talk about this anytime, so I look forward to the next time.
We will get you back. Thanks so much, Sharon. Be well.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest. And oh, and I should mention also Mazel Tov to Sharon on your daughter, Bryce Migdal, becoming a cantor in Orlando, Florida, getting her position.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town, amazing dining, and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest on Too Jewish, well, our guests will be Dahlia Davis and Becca Shimshak, founders of the Jewish organization Uprooted, which helps people struggling with fertility issues in both the Orthodox and the Reform world. Our playout today comes from Brazilian singer Micha Gamerman, and it's his Shavuot medley. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Chag Sameach for Shavuot this Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Uvaruch ulam bivrit yachad naseh v'nishma amruke. כאחד ובאו כולם בעברית יחד נעשה ונשמע אמרו 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 כאחד
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.